Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talk 150. My name is Poppy Bell, and I am one of the site team supervisors here at Chalk History Festival. I'm also an aspiring writer, and I'm about to take a master's degree in creative writing. So I could not be more excited to introduce someone who is truly an inspirational figure to me, Kate Moss. Kate is a novelist, short story writer, and broadcaster who writes incredible adventure and ghost fiction inspired by history. Her breakout novel in 2005, Labyrinth, sold over 10 million copies, was the best-selling book in the UK that year, and won the British Book Award. She has published 11 novels and short story collections and has garnered a reputation as one of the most loved and celebrated historical fiction writers in the UK. As a young female writer, I'm also particularly inspired by Kate's incredible activism for women in publishing. In 1996, she co-founded the annual award for the best UK published English language novel written by a woman that is now known as the Women's Prize for Fiction. She has worked tirelessly to help female authors launch and build their careers. She was awarded an OBE in 2013 and a CBE in 2024. She even has the distinction of leading the winning team on the Celebrity University Challenge in 2012. Kate is going to talk to us through the remarkable story that inspired Labyrinth, the Albigensian crusade by Pope Innocent III against the Cathars. So please join me in giving Kate a warm welcome.
That was lovely. Well, hello, Chalk. How wonderful to be back. Oh, thank you. That was very lively for a Sunday afternoon. I'm extremely impressed. This is one of the great festivals, as you all know, because it is one of the places where you can come and have proper conversations with people who know stuff. And frankly, we need people who know stuff at the moment. So what I'm going to do is, I've never done this talk before, and I will never do it again. I've written it just for today. So yes, thank you. And if it's a catastrophe, then it's a secret between us, okay? All of you here, it's a secret. It's because of a novel that I wrote that Poppy mentioned 20 years ago called Labyrinth. So I'm going to tell you about the real history behind it, a particular crusade that was launched against the people of the southwest of France, and take you through the main things that happened, the real history behind the fiction, if you like. I will, if I don't run out of time, take some questions. But as I said, I've never done this talk before, so it might be 3 hours long. And then we'll all just be leaving one by one, and last one out turns off the lights. So, this is Carcassonne. Who's been to Carcassonne? Oh, look at you all. So, it was 1989, and we bought a tiny house in the shadow of the medieval city walls of Carcassonne. And it was a place that I'd never even heard of before, let alone visited. And we were only there because of a coincidence and a happenstance. But we arrived in November 1989, my husband and my wonderful mother-in-law, Granny Rosie, having gone ahead in August and come back at the end of a weekend, having spent 20,000 francs, ladies and gentlemen, on a tiny house. And I was quite offended, actually, that they'd gone to France and bought a house without me. But needs must. So I arrived there in November, and it was cold and it was misty. And those of you who know France will know that there's this thing that happens 1 minute past seven out of season. Everybody vanishes. So we got off the train, because these were the days before Ryanair, and we walked down through the town, and every now and again, I would hear the sound of footsteps somewhere in the mist, but we didn't see anybody. And then we got to the old bridge, the Pont Vieux, that separates Carcassonne-Basseville, the main town, the commercial town, from the medieval citadel that sits ahead on the hill. And I stepped up onto the bridge and I saw it. I saw this for the first time, this incredible crown of stone sitting atop the hill. And you know, it was just a coup de foudre. I just fell madly in love. And more than that, I thought, oh, I belong here. So over the next few years, as it became a home from home and we had our daughter and then we had our son, I started to read about this place that I was thinking of as home, because that's what you do when you fall in love, isn't it? And I started to read about a group of so-called heretical Christians called the Cathars, who had lived and been persecuted and died in that part of France in the 11th, 12th and 13th century. And again, those of you who will know France will know that there is a very odd tradition, which is that the people that translate the guidebooks from French into English don't really speak English. So you start to read about these extraordinary Christians, and all the time I was thinking, that cannot possibly be true. So I was forced to kind of buff up my schoolgirl French. And little and little, I started to learn about the crusade preached against this group of Christians, known as the Albigensian Crusade, and started to learn that this crusade was the first crusade preached by a Christian against fellow Christians on Christian soil. And I also discovered that Carcassonne itself, if you like, lives in the shadow of its medieval past. At the same time, I learned that there'd been a settlement there for a very, very long time. So, in 3000 BCE, there we go, Roman towers, 3000 BCE, there were Neolithic hunter-gatherers who created a settlement on what we now call Carcassonne, on top of the hill by the river. In 600 BCE, the main tribe of that part of France was the Gauls. And you know about the Gauls, ladies and gentlemen, because you have read your Asterix. The Romans, of course, came next. 118 BCE, they built the Via Domitia that linked their territories all the way across in Italy, across the southwest of France, as we think about it, the south of France, Occitania, Narbonne, Galicia, all the way to their territories in what we would now call Spain. And there are some towers still left. These three towers are still the shape of the Roman towers that were there. And you can tell if you go to Carcassonne, because if you look, you can see red thin tiles that are inside the stone, and they are a different shape. They are flatter. And it's amazing to stand there and know that Roman centurions walked past these towers all of those years ago. In 58 BCE, there was a new governor of this part of France, and his name was Julius Caesar. And he gave it the name Carcassonne. 33 CE, and you all know what happened then. A man was executed in the city of David in Jerusalem. His name was Jesus, and it was the beginning of a new religion. And this new religion will soon spread all over the world, and it will spread to this part of France. But as you know, as Heraclitus says, there is nothing permanent except for change, and this changing going on within Carcassonne means that it is a place that is always swapping hands. And this is very important for how the crusade manages to become so important all of these years later. The Visigoths start to be in charge in our part of France, as I can think of it. And they are Arian Christians. And then in 507, we have the Franks. And they are a brand new tribe, and they've come down from what we would call Belgium and northern France, and they make their way down. Back to Jerusalem, and it is 632 CE, and a prophet called Muhammad ascends from what is called the Dome of the Rock into heaven. And nearly 20 years later, his revelations are written down in a book that becomes the Quran. And this is the beginning of another new religion that will again change the face of this part of France. And now the king of the Franks is a man called Charlemagne. And the Saracens, as the Muslims are called in Europe, have pushed all the way up through Spain. And they have come across the Pyrenees, and they have taken over this part of France. And by the 8th century, the city on the hill, Carcassonne, is in Saracen hands. This, if any of you have been to Carcassonne, is a very famous mural, and it's halfway up the walk that goes from the river up to the medieval citadel. And it is almost probably the most photographed mural in all of Carcassonne. And why is that? Because it's a really steep hill. Nobody really cares about this mural, but everybody stops to take a photograph because they are out of breath. And this are the Saracen warriors, and this is how the story of Carcassonne gets its name comes about. This is entirely bogus history, I should say. It was made up in the 19th century to give Carcassonne a bit of cachet. But It comes back to this woman called Dame Kakas. And she and her husband, Balak, now are in charge of the city on the hill. And the story goes that Charlemagne has been besieging the city on the hill for many, many years. And Balak dies, and Dame Kakas thinks, okay, what am I going to do in order to keep defending the citadel? I don't have enough men for the garrison. So she fills clothes with straw, quite literally straw men, and puts them all around the battlements to give the impression that she still has enough of an army. But this doesn't really fool anybody for very long. So in the end, she asks for the one remaining animal who's left inside the citadel to be brought to her, and this is a pig. And they are force-feeding the pig with grain, and then they throw the pig over the battlements. The pig goes down to the ground, its belly splits open, and undigested grain comes out. At which point, so the story goes, Charlemagne's general turns to him and says, "Sire, there is no point continuing this siege for a seventh or an eighth year. They still have enough food to even give it to the animals." And Charlemagne, in what I'm reliably told is the language of the time, says, "It's a fair cop." And he gathers his army, lifts the siege, and marches away. At which moment, a trumpet rings out. It is Carcassonne calling. And the general turns to Charlemagne again. He said, "Can you hear that, sire? Carcass calls, Carcassonne." I know, it's terrible. It is a terrible, terrible story. But that is la vraie légende de how Carcassonne got its name. But the Saracens in their turn are defeated in 973, and now there's a new dynasty, new kids on the block, and they are the Trancavel dynasty, and they will be the heroes of our story about the defending of the south against the north. In 1067, Raymond Bernard will make Carcassonne the center of his empire, which is growing and includes Béziers and the Razès and Albi, as well as Carcassonne. And in 1130, he will build the Château Cantal, which many of you will have visited, and it will become one of the glories of 12th century France. And in 1185, a son will be born, Raymond Roger Trancavel, and he is the hero of the Mehdi in the story of the Albigensian Crusade. But before we get to him, I think it's the right moment to say, well, who were the Cathars? Well, the first thing to say is they would not have been called Cathars at the time. They were sometimes known as Cathari or Catharos. A German monk talked them about them as Catharos. They were usually called Albigensians because so many of them came from the southern city of Albi. And in fact, they were known as Albigensians right up until the early 20th century. Their priests were called parfait or parfait if they were women. But the people of the southwest of France who followed them would simply have called them this: bonhomme, bonne femme, good men, good women. Now, they were dualists. What that means is that they saw everything in terms of equal but opposing forces. If you go all the way back to the third century, the prophet Mani was, you know, the Manichaeism some of you will have heard of. This was a dualist philosophy. So if you like, it's light versus dark, good versus evil. And in Catharism, God is the good God in heaven, and the earth and everything in it belongs to the devil. They have no concept of hell or judgment, because if you like, this is it. This is bad as it gets. They believed in the reincarnation of souls, the idea that you would be reincarnated until you were pure enough to return to heaven. And when all the good spirits were back in heaven, then that would be that. That would be the end of everything. Because of that, they were vegetarian, because obviously you wouldn't want to eat Auntie Ethel if she had been reincarnated into a cat, for example. But they also, extraordinarily, had female priests, because Cathars talked about bodies as being tunics of flesh. And if everything on the earth belongs to the devil, then it doesn't matter which body you're put into, does it? So they had female and male priests. And all of these things made this a very challenging religion for the Catholic Church, as you can imagine. But the key thing I would say is this, that the Catholic Church in the southwest of France, a very long way from the Pope, a very long way from the Île-de-France, from Paris, which nobody really, you know, France wasn't a country as we think of it in those days. There were many Catholic priests who were 2 years old or 3 years old. They were children just put in to be in charge of a church. And the money that was being taken, if you like, the Catholic priest was seen as corrupt and as venial and as selling indulgences and selling, if you like, the birthright. And the Catholic churches in the south were empty. And people were attracted to Catharism because it seemed simple. It seemed much closer to a message of original Christianity than anything else. And by the middle of the 12th century, Catharism had become, if you like, the default religion in the southwest of France, in our bit of France. The church councils had ruled against it, but they had not gone quite as far as they did in 1176, when they announced that Catharism was now a heresy. And that meant something very, very different. Heretics and heresy were seen as actually more challenging than being an infidel, than being a Saracen, or being a Jewish person, or being any other kind of religion. Because the idea was that an infidel had never heard the truth, so hadn't turned away. But a heretic was much more dangerous because they had heard the truth of the Gospels and had chosen to turn away. And they started to think, if you like, the French king of the time, Philip II, and the Pope, started to think about how they might re-educate the people of the South. And the man they chose to do it was a Spanish monk who goes by the name of Dominic Gutzmann. You will know him better as Saint Dominic. So he started a campaign, a preaching campaign. And this is one of the most famous pictures of this. Obviously, it's not contemporary. This is a 15th century painting. But this story goes that he had gone from place to place to place with the Catholic bishops and meeting the Cathar bishops. And they were trying to argue it out, if you like, as points of doctrine. And this is the moment where Dominic, as you can see, he has got his halo by now. He explains everything about why the Cathars are heretics. The people over there are the Cathar bishops. There are five bishoprics in the southwest of France at this moment. And they explain everything about why they consider their Christianity the true Christianity. Then, so the story goes, and do bear in mind this was written by a Catholic commentator. Dominic throws his testimony into the fire. The Cathar bishops throw their testimony into the fire. The Cathar testimonies are burnt, but unbelievably, ladies and gentlemen, Dominic's testimony is thrown out of the fire, unharmed. And this is the key moment. But of course, it persuaded nobody. And we know, don't we, that religious war is not about faith. It's about power and domination and imposing your views on other people at the point of a sword or at the end of a faggot. And in the end, where persuasion has failed, force very quickly will prevail. The background to the crusade against the Cathars is, of course, the crusades that had started a century or so earlier. The First Crusade, 1095 to 1099. It became, if you like, in the Second and the Third and the Fourth Crusades, a way of life for European people. One of the reasons that there were so many people who went on crusades, men who went on crusades, is this, that in the South and the North, there was a different system of inheritance. In the North, there is something called primogeniture, and it was the same in England as well. And what that means is, essentially, that the eldest son gets the lot. What that resulted in was a lot of very irritated, angry, disruptive second, third, and fourth sons. And the church had come up with a very good wheeze called indulgences, which is essentially that if you gave your sword for this holy crusade, for 40 days, you would gain a remission of sins. So it was an attractive offer, both for parents who wanted to pack off troublesome younger sons, and also for young men who maybe were living a bit of a life of Riley were going to be let off all their sins if they took the cross and went to Jerusalem. And this was the context within which everything that happened in the Albigensian Crusade was being lived. The Second Crusade, the Third Crusade, the Siege of Acre, 1189, 1192. I always pause slightly on that one because there was, in my novel Labyrinth, I have an imaginary character at the Siege of Acre. But I put him there because one of my ancestors was at that siege. Philip de Moss was there at the Siege of Acre, and it is where we got our family coat of arms all of that time ago. And when I was writing the novel, the idea of this imagined male character and a real ancestor who I will never know, the idea of them maybe passing in the imaginary streets of Labyrinth was very powerful, because every time you can make some kind of personal connection when you're writing, of course, it lifts the story into being the story of real people who lived and died. The Fourth Crusade was a disaster. Most people never arrived. One of the things about crusading is you see all these films and you think about it as battles and sieges. But the majority of crusaders who came from Europe to the Holy Land didn't even make it. They died from dysentery. They died en route. The ships went down. And this, again, will be very important to explain, if you like, why so many people signed up, as it were, to fight fellow Christians on French soil. And one of the people who was there in the Fourth Crusade was a man called Simon de Montfort. This is Innocent III, a more terrible name for a pope I cannot imagine. The rumblings between the Catholics and the Cathars had been going on, as we've seen, for quite a long time. But as always, with something that explodes into a confrontation, and we've just seen this recently in the last few years, haven't we? There's one action that quite often puts the flame to the bonfire and sets everything going. And the moment at which it turned from individual burnings of Cathars in particular places, if you like, a battle that was essentially theological between bishops, was the murder of a papal legate called Peter of Castelnau in 1208. It is thought, because it was the day after he had visited Raymond VI of Toulouse, who was the most powerful of the southern landowners, that maybe the knight that killed Peter was in the pay of Raymond VI. We will never know if that's true or not, but the French king and the Pope decided it was so. And at that moment decided that they would now send an invasionary force, essentially, to take over the rich, fertile, peace-loving lands of Languedoc. So they gathered in Lyon at Easter 1209. And there were perhaps as many as 20,000 soldiers of Christ. And they were promised this: if you give your 40 days, you will have the remission of sins, not just for now, but for all of your life. And unsurprisingly, many people rushed to sign up. The barons of the north, Chartres, Evreux, they were all there. The spiritual leader of the crusade was the abbot of Citeaux. We know a lot of this for an extraordinary reason, that there is a contemporary poem called La Chanson de la Croisade, the Song of the Crusade. And it was written by a man called Guillaume de Tudela, and he wrote from 1208 to 1219 what he saw. In the middle of that, he disappears. We don't know if he was killed in battle, whether he was just sickened by what he was watching, but he stopped writing and an anonymous poet took the rest of the poem on. But it means that we have extraordinary descriptions of the crusaders as they set out from Lyon. There were barges on the Rhone, and the poet describes the army as a serpent of weapons making its way to the south. What is also important to say is that they would not have been called crusaders. In the same way that Cathar is a modern word for describing these believers, this army was simply called the host, and it made its way south. The main protagonists in the south are Raymond VI of Toulouse, who I just mentioned, and Raymond Roger Trincavel, who is, as I said, the hero of the Midi. He is, at this moment, Raymond Roger, the Viscount of Carcassonne, Albi, Béziers, and the Razès. He is not a Cathar, but he is known to be a man of toleration. And we have his words saying this: "Anybody who lives in my lands, be they Jew or Saracen, Cathar or Catholic, if they follow the rules of our lands, they should be treated equally and with dignity." And his people loved him. Raymond VI is his liege lord. This is a period of time where everybody has their place and everybody knows where they stand. There are many minor knights and barons, if you like, who look up to Raymond Roger Trincavel, and it's his responsibility to protect them and defend them. He, in turn, looks up to his two liege lords, who are Pedro of Aragon and Raymond of Toulouse. And Raymond of Toulouse is his uncle. Now, Raymond of Toulouse has been having a grudge, if you like, with the French king and the northern barons for some time. He again protects Cathars in his area. He has been excommunicated for not persecuting the Cathars in 1207. He is reconciled. He then gets excommunicated again. But now he sees an enormous army coming down the Rhone and from the north. And they arrive in Toulouse, in Saint-Gilles, and they are in Montpellier also. And at this moment, Raymond realizes that there is nothing he can do to stand against this army. They are just too well stocked. There are too many of them. So he does an extraordinary thing. He throws himself, if you like, on the good offices of the Pope. He says that he will take the Crusader cross and march with them against his nephew if his lands are spared. And he, in this place, Saint-Gilles in Toulouse, undergoes a punishment of scourging, walking naked through the streets, is being beaten, and prostrates himself before the abbot of Citeaux, and he is allowed back into the Catholic Church. At this moment, everything changes, because together the barons of the south might have fought against this enormous army from the north, but divided they will fall. So as opposed to starting to go through Raymond's lands, they instead turn their eyes to Béziers and the lands of Raymond Roger Trincavel, because Béziers is the first on the route of the Via Domitia. You remember that, the Via Domitia that the Romans built. And a messenger goes to Carcassonne, to Raymond Roger Trincavel, and the messenger gives this message that the Count of Toulouse, your uncle, has taken the Crusader cross. And of course, he can't believe it to start with, but he's persuaded in the end that this is true. So Raymond Roger Trincavel rides to Béziers because it is the first city on the road that the Crusaders will come to. And he goes in and he says to the people of Béziers, "You must defend the city with courage and with virtue." And then he leaves and he says, "I will send reinforcements to support you." Béziers is high on a hill with very narrow postern gates. It's considered impregnable. And when he goes, he takes the Jewish population of Béziers with him because he does not believe that they will be treated properly by the Crusaders. The Crusaders march into his territories. They arrive outside Béziers on the 21st of July, 1209, and they set up camp by the River Orb, expecting to be there for quite a long siege. A messenger goes from the abbot of Citeaux, from the Crusaders, into the city. On it is a list of some 200, that's all, 200 Cathars who are living in Béziers. And they say, "If you give us this people, we will interrogate them, and if they will not recant their Cathar faith, we will burn them, but we will spare the rest of you." And the leaders of Béziers say, "But they are our friends and our neighbors." And the messenger is sent back to the camp. What happens next is what I can only really describe as a bit of medieval willy-waving. On the 22nd of July, it is the feast day of St. Mary Magdalene, and a group of young men decide that they will come out from the postern gate of Béziers and go down to the river to taunt the Catholics. There's 20,000 of them there, remember? Some of them are under the trees, some of them by the water. They go out. They start to hurl insults. I imagine people's mothers are mentioned. Who knows what they said or what they thought they were doing? It gets a bit argy-bargy. It's like, you know, being in Bognor Regis on a Saturday night. And then it gets physical. And they start to throw things. And some of the Catholics are coming a bit nearer and they're throwing things. And it just escalates and it escalates until one Catholic soldier comes a little bit too close to this group of men from Béziers. And he is seized. And he is beaten. And he is killed. And his body is thrown into the river. At which moment, the men from Béziers think maybe, just maybe, they have gone a little too far. And they turn and they start to walk back and then run back to the postern gate. But Catholic soldiers have seen what's happened to their friends and they are following and they are faster. And the Béziers boys keep running and they get to the gate and they get through, but they do not secure it properly. And within moments, first hundreds and then thousands of soldiers are streaming into the impregnable city through the open gate. And nobody expects it to happen, so it is completely lawless. And people are being hacked down in the street, men, women, children, everywhere. It is a bloodbath. And as this goes on, one soldier, one can only assume has some kind of conscience, turns to the abbot of Citeaux and said, "But sire, how do we tell the good Catholics from the bad? How do we tell the Catholics from the Cathars?" And he says something which, if you like, sets the tone for the crusade that will follow over the next generation. He says, "Kill them all, God will know his own." And that is the signal for nearly 20,000 people who will be slaughtered in the space of a couple of hours. In the churches where they're taken sanctuary, nobody is spared, babies, children, men, women. A messenger gets out and goes riding to Raymond Roger Trancaval in Carcassonne to tell him the unthinkable has happened, that Béziers has fallen. And they start to do their fortifications. Everybody else is now hearing what has happened, the genocide at Béziers. The man who invented, came up with the word genocide, as you know, is a man called Raphael Lemkin, a Polish Jewish law student who first used it in 1943, we think maybe 1944, to describe the indiscriminate slaughter of an entire group of people just for being who they were. He said that he thought the massacre of the Cathars was a genocide. And this news is spreading out. So as the crusaders move on, they thought they'd be in Béziers for the summer, but they're now moving on along the Via Domitia. They get to Narbonne. Narbonne opens its gates. It surrenders straight away. It goes further to Alzil all the way along. Everybody just opens their gates and surrenders to the north, who are now taking territory without even having to fight for it. And then they arrive on the 1st of August before the walls of Carcassonne. But Raymond Roger Trancaval will not surrender. He will not give up his people. So begins the siege of Carcassonne. It begins on the 1st of August. The problem is, it is very, very hot. There are two suburbs below the city walls, and there is a Jewish quarter. The crusaders attack the Jewish quarter first, and the city takes in all of the refugees that it can. They attacked Saint-Vincent next, and the city again takes in all the refugees it can. And they are sending out soldiers and knights to fight. Because although siege warfare was the main thing that happened in the medieval period, as you know, there were also sorties out, chevaliers trying to win in hand-to-hand combat. But they, of course, are hugely outnumbered. And they are trapped within the city. And then on the 7th of August, the crusaders get control of the water supply. They start to poison the wells and they have control of the river. And siege sickness is now spreading through the city. That is, of course, dysentery. Then Trancaval's other liege lord arrives, Pedro of Aragon. And again, Trancaval assumes that he's come to support him, but he hasn't. He's come to tell him to surrender because there's no way that he can win. But we all know, don't we? If you give in to a bully, they just keep coming. So Trankafel fights on, but he fights on alone. He holds out until the 15th of August. At this moment, and I think this is because he was a man of honor and genuinely cared about all of his citizens, whoever they were, he decides that the only way to spare his people is to sacrifice himself. So he goes to the Crusader camp and he hands over his sword and says, I will surrender my lands and my viscounty, provided you let all of my people, all of them, go unharmed. And this is agreed to. And this is a very famous painting, 15th century painting, which is held by the British Library in London, of the expulsion of the Cathars. And they are allowed to leave with only the clothes on their back. But there is no repetition of the massacre of Béziers. Now, very clear rules governed medieval warfare. A noble soldier who had surrendered should have been expected to be treated in certain ways. He would have been a prisoner, yes, but he would have been looked after well. But instead what happens, because the Crusaders are not men of honor, Trankafel is seized, and he is thrown into his own dungeon. And there he will be found dead 3 months later. And his viscounty will be given to a man called Simon de Montfort, the same Simon de Montfort who had been at the Fourth Crusade. And de Montfort, to give him his credit, was genuinely a man of pious belief. Many of the Crusaders were just there for loot and for land, but he did genuinely believe that the Cathars would be damned forever. But he does something very strange. He is now the Viscount of these extraordinary lands of Béziers, Albi, Carcassonne, and the Razès. But instead of just accepting that and ruling as he could have done, he embarks what I can only call a scorched earth policy. This is the famous map of the Crusades. This is the map that I have had on my wall behind my writing desk for 20 years. And it was very bright blue once, but it has been faded by the sun. And this shows all of the battles, and I'm not going to pick them all out, but just a few. So in November 1209, they are burning Cathars in Castres. In the spring of 2010, they are in a place called Bram. At that moment, they send soldiers into the city. They put out the eyes of every single person who is living there, bar one, who is left to lead the mutilated people of Bran through the countryside as a warning to any who would resist the Crusaders. In July, they besiege Minerve. They capture the city very quickly, and 140 Cathars are burnt. In the spring and autumn, they are in the mountains, in the Pyrenees, at Termin, at Puyvert, and these are men who own these castles built from the same cloth as Raymond Roger Trankafel, and they resist and they fight back, but it's not enough. And the castles fall. Crusading works to a season. When the autumn comes, everybody packs up, people go home. They don't continue the sieges over the winter, oddly. They all start up again in March. So there are whole periods of time when nothing much is happening. There are skirmishes trying to take back some of the lands. In spring 1211, they are in Lavaur. This story has gone down as a famous one because there is a very famous Cathar Parfait, a female preacher who lives there, and she is seized and stoned and thrown down a well, again as a warning to anybody who would resist and continue to preach Catharism. They assault Toulouse, but they do not take the city, and Toulouse will be the turning point of this part of the Crusade. In the autumn of that year is the Battle of Castle Nodary. There are very few pitched battles. This is one where the people of Castle Nodary fight the Crusaders, but in the end, they lose. September 1213, the Battle of Muret, Pedro of Aragon, Trankafel's liege lord, who should have supported him in the first place, has now realized you shouldn't give in to a bully, and he has changed sides, and he is now fighting back, but it's too little, and it's too late, and Pedro is killed on the battlefield, and the Aragonese go back over the mountains. And then finally, we get to June 1218. And this is another siege of Toulouse. And we know about this because the poet, Guillaume de Tillela, wrote about the siege of Toulouse. And we know that there were big trebuchets and mangonels all the way around the walls. And we know that one of them was operated by women and by girls. And in this one, a huge boulder is put into the cradle and it is catapulted over the wall and it strikes and hits and kills Simone de Montfort. And the cry goes up, the wolf is dead. And it looks just for a moment that maybe the Cathars will have a reprieve. Because if the leader of the crusade is dead and nobody else wants to take over, then it would be quite easy to just gently go back to life that has been lived. But I'm afraid it was just a pause, because the writing is on the wall for the Cathars and the independence of the South. What happens is that there is a change of pope and a change of king. Raymond VI, who is flip-flopped backwards and forwards, is now fighting the French king. He can see that this is about the independence of the South, not just his lands. There is a new king, Louis VIII, and he takes over in 1223, and he only rules for 3 years, but it's a very significant period. And there is a new pope, Gregorius. But in the end, in 1229, the military part of the Albigensian Crusade comes to an end when Raymond VII, the son of Raymond VI, accepts a peace treaty. And so the military side of things, if you like, looks like it's won. The South was an independent state. It now isn't. It's now under the control of the French king. But the campaign against the Cathars starts to enter a new phase, a new terrible phase. And it's this. You remember Dominic, Saint Dominic, who he actually dies in 1221. And his order, the Dominicans, has been instituted just a couple of years before that. But in 1233, what happens is the founding of the Inquisition. Now, many of you will associate the Inquisition with Spain a century later. But in fact, the Inquisition was founded absolutely to get rid of the Cathars. And this changes everything, because it starts now to turn neighbor against neighbor, friend against friend. What had been happening was that people would hide when the soldiers came, the Cathars would hide when the soldiers came, and then come back out again. And communities were just living relatively peacefully. But now inquisitors are being sent from village to village to village, and they are saying, you tell me where the Cathars are, or I will take your children and your wife and your sons. And so people start to inform on other. It's like a Stasi state. And this changes the language and the atmosphere, if you like, of the southwest of France. The final moment is when Raymond Trancavel, the son of Raymond Roger Trancavel, gathers an army in 1240 and tries to take back Carcassonne. And he fails. And he goes into hiding. And at this moment, all the Cathars are now moving back and they are taking refuge in mountain citadels. And this is the most famous of them. I'm sure I can see some of you smiling. You have been there, Montségur, in the Pyrenees. And this, for me, was where I became a novelist. I first went there in the March of, I suppose it must have been about 1995 or six. And I knew the history of what happened at Montségur in March 1244, where 400 people who had been living under siege for 7 months came down the mountain, 200 of them Cathars, and were burnt in an enormous pyre. And their monument stands there on what's called the Field of the Burnt. And I knew that it was the final nail in the coffin of the independence of the South. And although it wasn't the end of Catharism, the whisper of Catharism, as the great French historian Anne Brennan calls it, would go on for another century or so. But it was the moment at which, in the end, the South was lost and Catharism was lost. And I had all of this tragedy and knowledge in my mind when I went there for the first time and walked up the mountain on my own. And it's 1,200 meters above sea level. And you could see it. Look at that. Just imagine building that castle and living there under siege. And this is the monument simply to the Cathars that was put up in 1960. And these are the steps that led up. And it was overcast and it was grey when I went, the same time of year as the citadel had fallen. And I knew that they had been there living quite comfortably because nobody could get in. But of course, finally, they managed to get up. The Crusaders managed to get up trebuchets and started to bombard. And can you imagine living there, a ceaseless bombardment day and night? And of course, the siege had started in August 1243. And again, there had been a particular event that gave the Crusaders an excuse to attack the citadel. And that had been the murder of two inquisitors in a place called Avignonet-le-Reguet. And they had fled back to Montségur. And at that moment, they said, we are going to finish these people for good. I also knew, and this, of course, lies at the heart of the novel Labyrinth, that there was a belief that the Cathars had a great treasure. Some people believe that it was the Grail, others believe that it was a book. Some people think it might just have been money. But certainly four Cathars left the mountain in the January and took something to safety. And as a historical novelist, when the history cannot be proved, that is when you have your chance. And we know the identity of three of those people. They were men, but the fourth, we don't know. Could it have been a woman? So this is what happened. I walked up the mountain and I had all of these stories in my mind, all of those people who had lived there. And they'd been offered this peace that if they surrendered, then although everybody could come down the mountain and they would have to make their testimony before the Inquisition, if they recanted, they would be allowed to go free with just one chilling thing, that they would have to wear a yellow cross sewn to their clothes. But nobody recanted. But they asked for 2 weeks' grace between the 1st of March and the 15th of March. And we don't know what they did or why they asked for the grace period, because they were cold and starving and desperate. They wanted to stay in the citadel for those 2 weeks longer. We know that Easter fell within that time period. We don't know anything more than that. Kept climbing. I climbed up through the cloud cover. And this is France in 1996. And the French don't really do health and safety. So their view is, if you go on a wall and it's icy and there's no railings and you fall off and die, it's your own fault. You shouldn't have gone on the wall. There was nobody else there. So I climbed up the icy steps and I stood on the ruined battlements. And I thought two things. I thought, what would it have felt like to stand here on the 16th of March, 1244, and look out on such incredible beauty, the beauty of the Pyrenees, and know that you would never see it again. And more than that, all the people that you loved would, in a matter of hours, die, and die horribly. And then, out of the corner of my eye, really, I just felt that I could see something. A woman in a red cloak, pulling it around herself. I knew nothing about her, but that she was a Cathar woman standing there. And it's the moment at which the thing that has inspired all of my writing, fiction and nonfiction, ever since, began for the first time. The whispering in the landscape. The idea that there, if you just closed your eyes for long enough and listened hard enough, you would hear the voices of people who had a story that you could tell. And then it was over, and I walked back down the mountain, and I was reunited with my husband and my mother-in-law and our two young children who were building a snowman beside the memorial to the Cathar martyrs who died that day. And I didn't really think anything more about it. 8 years later, when I was writing that chapter in the novel that became Labyrinth, about the lead character, Alaïs, at Montségur, I found myself typing, and Alaïs pulled her red cloak around herself. And I thought, oh, it's you. I met you all those years ago, but I didn't know who you were. And that, my friends, is how novels work, which is different from history, but it's the way that it all fits together. So the fall of Montségur was not quite the end. Kerribus, another of Cathar's so-called castles, fell in 1255. And then the final Cathar Parfait, Guillaume Bellebast, was caught and executed in 1321. And Catharism is what they call an apostolic religion, which means that you need a priest to make a priest. So when all the priests are killed, there can be no more Cathars. Not everybody agrees with that, but that is actually how it works. So just to finish, I spent 15 years researching and writing Labyrinth, which is why AI is a disgrace. That's a different thing. And what I learned was this, that there are many different ways to tell history. Everyone here reads history in one form or another. Sometimes you need to write it straight, as it were, and we've all been to many of those talks. But other times, sometimes fiction is an easier way to do it. There's a great saying by the brothers Goncourt, which is, history is a novel that has been lived. A novel is history that could have been. Because particularly when you're writing stories of lost people, and very particularly within that, the stories of women, a lot of the evidence, if you like, has not been kept. Men and women built the world together. We've always been in the world together. We are better together. Women have lived all of this history, but the writing of history has left women out and given the impression that women weren't there. But in these periods of time where women inherited equally, where there were priests who were female and male, these stories have mostly been lost. And because the Cathars believed that everything on the earth was the devil's work, they didn't build anything and they didn't keep anything. Because why would you? There are only three of their texts that have survived. One is a beautiful New Testament in their language, which is Occitan, and it was punishable by death to own a Bible in Occitan. And they had great reverence for the whole of the New Testament. They didn't follow the Old Testament. They particularly had reverence for the Gospel of John, which of course has the lines, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." So they are, it's very hard to get a handle on them. But this is the point of fiction, that fiction can sometimes slip between the gaps of what we know and can verify and what common sense tells us must have happened. Because when you are a writer of historical fiction, you have to be a detective. You have to be a magpie. You have to follow not linear paths, but all the little clues that are dropped everywhere. And sometimes fiction is a better way to do that, for the obvious reasons. And it also means you don't have to write about all the Lateran councils and all the papal legates, of which there were very, very many. So Labyrinth came out 20 years ago. This, as I said, is a talk that I'm doing just here for Chalk, and then I shall forget about it. It's almost the anniversary. It published on the 5th of July, 2005, and it felt the right place to come and celebrate that. But the final thing to say is this, you know, Labyrinth changed my life. It made it possible for me to be a writer. Nobody writes a novel thinking it's going to be a way you make a living. And because of that, I've traveled all over the world and I've met so many people and I've heard so many different stories. And that is the end, the reason that we're all here, isn't it? Because when I started as a novelist, when I was first promoting Labyrinth, I would say, well, of course, we don't know we're living through history. We do now. We know we're living through history. And I would say this, that we need to find the courage and the strength of our convictions to stand up for what we know is right and what we believe in, as they did. Things don't actually change very much. The patterns of history don't change very much, but every single one of us has a voice and every single one of us can make a difference and use it. And at that moment, I have left a huge amount of time, 5 minutes, for questions. So I will take two or three questions, but thank you very much. There we are. Lovely. Lady at the back. We'll do as many as we can get in. Thank you.
When you're writing your historical novels, do you kind of have an idea of what you might write about and then do the research around it? Or do you research a period and then come up with a novel idea from that?
Lovely. Thank you. Great question. Quickly, all of my books, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, start from place. It's that whispering in the landscape. It's about being somewhere and thinking, here is a story for me. I never come up with an idea or a character. It's always, okay, here I stand and I can hear something. There are some places in the world that don't speak to me and others do. My latest series of books, Joubert Family Chronicles, it all started in South Africa and I had to go back and discover. I then do all the research, years of research, millions of words worth of research. And then once I think I know the world backwards, I then just start. Because I know the sort of story it's going to be. I know the spine of the real history, but I don't know what my story is. I don't know who my characters are. And I trust that they will turn up on the stage and keep me company. And that's how I work. It's a bit nerve-wracking because every time you think maybe it won't happen this time. But so far, so good. Thank you. Question there?
Thank you very much for your talk. Thank you very much for your talk. I was just wondering, why do you think the Cathars have got such a cultural significance? There are lots of heresy groups, but somehow the Cathars stand out. Why do you think that is?
I think that's a great question too. I think it's because, you know, it's very important to say some people see the Cathars in a very different way from the way that I do. They see them essentially almost as a death cult, you know, not wanting to perpetuate the human race and therefore being austere and starving themselves. And some of their rituals were around that. But I would say the reason that most ordinary people, for want of a better word, were attracted by them and still are, is that the clue is in the name, bonhomme, bonne femme, good men, good women. They lived simply. They lived through the fruits of their hands. They were carders. They were weavers. They traveled from place to place. They did not accumulate wealth. They were oddly unjudgmental because the idea was, of course, that the earth was the devil's work. So how could you do anything but your best? You could never be perfect. And that's why they didn't have the idea of hell and they didn't have the idea of other people sitting in judgment in quite the same sort of way. So it's a very oddly practical and gentle religion and any form of Gnosticism. Many people would say, whether it's the Waldensians, the Bogomils, the Manchians, and obviously the Cathars, many people feel that it's a much more genuine form of original Christianity before the Council of Nicaea, and before it became a kind of hierarchical structural thing. And of course, because anybody could be a Cathar, it wasn't bigoted in terms of against women, against people of other ethnicities, of other religions. So I think it just appealed because it seemed like a force for good in the world. And as you say, there are many people who still feel those things about Catharism. Thank you. Right, one more there, thank you.
Very much. Wonderful talk. Just wondering how or why you chose that particular title, Labyrinth.
T-shirts available. No, there are no T-shirts available. Sorry. Because I'm very interested in all of my fiction and non-fiction, but particularly fiction, in the idea of how often within stories of faith and war and the consequences of war, in every period of history, quite often there is an appropriation of older symbols in order to start a new religion or a new way of looking at things. If you like, hiding secrets behind other secrets. And when I was thinking about the Cathars and all the rumors about the Grail, and as you know, Hitler thought that the Cathars had the Grail, and he sent Nazi Grail hunters all over the southwest of France under the control of Himmler looking for the Cathar treasure, which he believed was the Grail. And those of you who know Wagner's Parsifal, a great opera, of course, there is Montsalvat within that, the safe mountain. And what is that? Montségur, the safe mountain. So what I wanted was a symbol that would help me to coalesce my fictional part of the story as opposed to the historical part of the story. So Labyrinth seemed a great symbol because Labyrinth sprang up all over Europe in the 13th century. They were used by people as a way of replacing a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. They were known as the Shema to Jerusalem. And they were, people would go round, pilgrims would go round on their knees or their feet to the center, and it represented enlightenment and the pilgrimage to Jerusalem. But nobody ever answered to my satisfaction why there were more labyrinths built in France in the medieval period than the whole of Europe put together. And every time you find a bit of research like that, you think, oh, I wonder what lies behind it. The only problem about the title is nobody can spell it. But there we go. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'll see you in the tent.